There was a class that had in seminary that was being taught by Ken Smith. Don't remember what the class was. I'm sure it had something to do with evangelism. But one time he had us over to his house and he asked us, "What's the greatest thing you've ever done?" I wish I knew the point of that exercise. As we went around the room trying to come up with something. What's the greatest thing you've ever done? Various things, various kinds of things were mentioned. But as I look at our memory work now for the month of May, which comes from Deuteronomy chapter 6, it makes me wonder, was he really pointing us to the greatest thing that we can do is to love the Lord our God? What is the greatest thing that you can do? You may be thinking of all sorts of things. You know, so there's that old song I remember from back in college years that was played at the time that Richard Nixon was actually elected after having failed in previous times, to dream the impossible dream. And, you know, to reach those impossible heights. And so here's this person who does these marvelous things in order to reach the heights. But isn't that God calls us to humility? And to see that the greatest job that we have is really to love the Lord our God. And so our memory verse for the month of May is going to be very familiar to those who were in David Weir's class and Christian Ed Hour back in the late 90s and the early part of the last decade, because we were reciting these verses, actually a few more than these verses, because there we were reciting not just verses 4 and 5, but I believe we went on through verse 9. And this is what you would have been saying if you were a Jew in Israel. And perhaps even today, some of them will continue to say these verses at the beginning of the day. And it's not a bad practice at all to begin the day with these verses, to be reminded that our greatest duty is to love the Lord our God. Well, this is in Deuteronomy chapter 6, and it's verses 4 and 5 that we are particularly looking at. But I'll begin reading with the first verse on through verse 9. "These are the commands, the decrees and laws the Lord your God directed me to teach you, to observe in the land that you are crossing the Jordan to possess, so that you, your children, and their children after them may fear the Lord your God as long as you live by keeping all his decrees and commands that I give you, and so that you may enjoy long life. Hear, O Israel, and be careful to obey so that it may go well with you and that you may increase greatly in a land flowing with milk and honey, just as the Lord, the God of your fathers, promised you. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates." We'll end our reading at that point. And as we noted, it is verses 4 and 5 in particular that we look at today, where we have, "Hear, O Israel." In fact, let's read those verses in unison, 4 and 5. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength." Deuteronomy 6, 4 and 5. Just briefly, think of those first three words there. Hear, O Israel. It's really calling your attention, isn't it? We have the same words at the beginning of verse 3. Hear, O Israel, and be careful to obey so that it may go well with you, and so forth. And now again, hear, O Israel. God is calling his people here to sit up and take notice. It's kind of a now hear this moment. Here's something, don't let it go by. Don't let it pass by you. But take notice of it. Some people will ask a question about whether they can ask a question. You ever notice that? Can I ask a question? Well, you just did. But at least it gets your attention to say, I have something that I'm wanting to ask and I want you to listen carefully to what I have to say, what I'm asking about. So God is calling his people to sit up and take notice. How important is it? Well, when we come to the New Testament, here's what Jesus had to say, that this is the foremost commandment. Let's go ahead and take the time to look at Mark chapter 12. Mark chapter 12, where Jesus is confronted about this, it's not this command that is mentioned to him, but he's asked about what the greatest commandment is. And so in Mark chapter 12, verse 28, we read, one of the teachers of the law, so it's somebody who should know, came and heard them debating, noticing that Jesus had given them a good answer. He asked him, of all the commandments, which is the most important? The most important one, Jesus answered, is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. The second is this, love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. Well said, the teacher. Well said, teacher, the man replied. You are right in saying that God is one and there is no other but him. To love him with all your heart, with all your understanding and with all your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself is more important than all burnt offerings and sacrifices. When Jesus saw that he had answered wisely, he said to him, you are not far from the kingdom of God. And from then on, no one dared ask him any more questions. So there you get a bit of a commentary on the passage that we're looking at. As Jesus cites it as the most important or the foremost commandment. In fact, isn't that what a Christian does? He loves God. And he loves his neighbor as well. What is a Christian? Well, there's the answer. So often we try to answer, I think, in terms of, yes, we're to believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, and so we do all these things. But I come back to that statement we mentioned this morning concerning the fact that it is a person that we are involved with. You love the Lord your God. That's the heart of Christianity. So here's the foremost commandment. What about this love then? Well, first of all, he says, you notice that you are to love him because he is alone the Lord. He alone is the Lord our God. Now, you might wonder the way it's worded there, whether that's really what it means. But when you look at the way it's dealt with back in Mark chapter 12, you see that that's the understanding where where Jesus says the lawyer is right when he says, you are right in saying that God is one and there is no other but him. So, first of all, it's pointing out that he is the only God. Beside him there is no other. Actually, the lawyer back there in Mark chapter 12 cites something from just a couple chapters earlier in Deuteronomy, from the fourth chapter, Where in verse 35 it says, "You were shown these things so that you might know that the Lord is God. Besides Him, there is no other." And the fact that He is the one living and true God deals with a couple of issues. One that was especially true back in the time that Israel lived, and another that's especially true later on. At the time that Israel was in the Old Covenant entering into the land of Canaan and living there, there was the thought, of course, the notion that here is a God that is a God of that country, and then there's another God who is a God of this country over here, and then there's a God of that country over there, and each has authority over its own area. You find that when Israel was taken into exile, and God sent lions among those who had been moved into the land of Israel, and they said, "We don't know the God of this land, and so send us some people who know the God of this land and would be able to tell us how He is to be worshipped." And so there's that notion that was true back in the Old Testament times. But then in the New Testament, even before the New Testament, where you get into the Greek mythology and the Roman mythology, you have many gods over the same area. And so it becomes another way in which God is unique in being designated as the only God, the Lord our God. He is one. Now, some people have, and I tend to agree with them, have said that this is an indication, it's likely an indication of the Trinity. Notice that in verses 4 and 5, in our Bibles, you have the word Lord in small caps. That means it is the covenant name of God, Yahweh. The older translation would have been a Jehovah. And you'll notice that it's there three times. The Lord our God, the Lord is one, love the Lord your God with all your heart. And so the very fact that it's given three times, and it almost seems to be extended a little bit, at least that second one, seems to be forced a bit in order to get that three times in there. But He is the one living and true God, and yet He is one God. A man who used to be in the Jehovah's Witnesses and came to faith in Jesus Christ has developed something where he looks in the Old Testament, sees things that are said about Yahweh, using the covenant name of God, and had about half a dozen names, for example, shepherd and so forth. And then he goes to the New Testament and sees those same things said about Jesus, that He is indeed the covenant God, along with the Father and the Holy Spirit, which, of course, many of the cults would deny. They would not recognize Him as being part of the Godhead. So He is the covenant God, and that covenant name is used here three times, being a reminder of the fact that God is a triune God, and yet is perfect in unity. It's not that the three are in even the slightest conflict with each other. This is the one then who brought them out of Egypt under the direction of Moses. Remember how Moses was in the Sinai Peninsula, and while there, God met him in the burning bush. And Moses was always trying to object, to get out from what God wanted him to do, and finally said, "Please, Lord, take somebody else, or get somebody else to do it." And God still wouldn't let him out of it. But at one point he said, "Well, when I go over there, when I go back to Egypt and talk to the people of Israel, They're going to say to me, how do you know that you have been sent? Who's the one that sent you? How do we know that God is going to deliver us? What's your name? And so he said, well, I am that I am. Tell him that I am has sent you. And so that covenant name is being used here, and it's that is the basis, really, for that word Yahweh, that name Yahweh, I am. He is the God of the promise, and he fulfills the promise. He is the one that he said he would be, and he is the one who was taking them up into the land of Canaan in order that they might have it. At this point, of course, in Deuteronomy chapter 6, they are just on the banks of the Jordan River, ready to cross over into the land, but they haven't possessed it yet. But this God who has brought them up there is the one who will take them into the land, and he's the one you're to love, and you're to love him with your whole being. We are to know him then in his glory. We are to see him in that glory. And that's one of the reasons I was having us sing the first portion of the 18th Psalm. Because there the psalmist is saying, here's who you are, O God. My strength, my fortress, my rock, and so forth. So that it says, he's saying, here's who God is. Here's this person that I am to know. And it's as I come to know this person, then, that I love him. And I fulfill the duties that he has given to me. Going back to Mark chapter 12, and that incident where Jesus was asked about the most important commandment or the greatest commandment, I want you to see what else the lawyer said to him. Well said, teacher, the man replied, you are right in saying that God is one, and there is no other but him. And then he says, to love him with all your heart, with all your understanding, and with all your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself, is more important than all burnt offerings and sacrifices. Now, wait a minute. To the Jew, there was nothing more important, really, than those sacrifices. They had been ordered through the law of Moses to offer those sacrifices. And as long as they offered those sacrifices and offerings, and even came with extra ones, that was the thing to do. And that was how they would have their salvation. And the lawyer says, no, it's in loving the Lord our God wholeheartedly. It's in pursuing him. Not in the fulfillment of a set of tasks, but rather in loving God completely. And that's the way that we are to be defined. We are not those who offer sacrifices. We are not defined as those who go to worship services every Lord's Day. We are not defined as those who are Sabbatarian and so keep the Lord's Day holy. We are not defined as psalm singers. We are defined by loving God. And all these other things that we do come from the very fact that we love God and that we're going to pursue him. We're going to love him completely. It's that person that we come to, not a set of rules. So, here is our foremost duty that Jesus sets before us, and that God set before Israel back in chapter 6 of Deuteronomy. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength. And you'll notice that by the time you get to the New Testament, there's a fourth one that's added, with all your mind. And so it is that it's indicating the fullness of the love that we have for God. It's our foremost duty because, after all, He is our deliverer. If you really come to an appreciation of what Christ has done on the cross and all that God has done for you, does it not compel you to love Him? And that's why we need to stop and consider what it is that God has done for us. That's one of the reasons I think that He appointed the weekly convocation. To step back and say, here's who God is, and we are here to worship Him. We are to honor Him. We are to exalt Him. We appreciate His grace to us. All that He has done for us. But we also appreciate the magnificent character of God. His omnipotence. His complete wisdom. Being able to be everywhere present at the same time. We're not talking about the speed of light. That's way too slow. But He is everywhere at once. Think of those attributes that are mentioned in the definition of God that are given us in the Catechism. How He is infinite, eternal, and unchangeable in His being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth. It's magnificent. Infinite in all of those things. Eternal in all of those things. And He is to be glorified for His magnificence. And these things compel us then to love Him. It's kind of like wanting to be on the winning team. And certainly as you are with God, you are on that. After all, He destroys the wicked, but He draws you who love Him to Himself. And then all the terms that are used here, with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. And the repetition of the words, it's not just with all your heart, soul, and strength. But it's with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. And that just kind of adds weightiness to it all. Emphasizing that you express this love by your entire being. By every activity of your life. It's the core of your existence. It's who you are. It guides every decision you make. Why are you on the computer following that little path that's off to the side there to go and see what it's talking about? Is it because you love the Lord your God? Or is that something that might be contrary to the Lord your God, to loving the Lord your God? Why is it that I am doing this? Is it because I love the Lord my God? It is to guide every decision that we make. Love for the Lord is not something that's controlled by economics either. Let's look again at the New Testament. And you'll notice that the love for the Lord is something that is to be shown lavishly. Lavishly. First of all, from Luke chapter 7, we have an incident where Jesus is invited to the home of one of the Pharisees. And while there, we read, when a woman who had lived a sinful life in that town learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house, she brought an alabaster jar of perfume, and as she stood behind Him at His feet weeping, she began to wet His feet with her tears, and she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, and poured perfume on them. When the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner. Jesus answered him, Simon, I have something to tell you. Tell me, teacher, he said. Two men owed money to a certain moneylender. One owed him 500 denarii, the other 50. Neither of them had the money to pay him back, so he canceled the debts of both. Now, which of them do you think will love him more? Simon replied, I suppose the one who had the bigger debt. You have judged correctly, Jesus said. Then he turned toward the woman and said to Simon, do you see this woman? I came into your house. You did not give me any water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman from the time I entered has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. Therefore, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, for she loved much. But he who has been forgiven little loves little. She appreciated what Jesus had done for her, how he had provided for her the forgiveness of sins and delivered her from the power of sin and darkness. Now, there's another incident later on, apparently, in the... it's enough difference that it seems to me it's a different incident, and yet there's a lot of similarity in it. And that's in Mark chapter 14. Beginning with verse 3, we read, while he was in Bethany, reclining at the table in the home of a man known as Simon the leper, a woman came with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume made of pure nard. She broke the jar and poured the perfume on his head. Some of those present were saying indignantly to one another, why this waste of perfume? It could have been sold for more than a year's wages and the money given to the poor. And they rebuked her harshly. Leave her alone, said Jesus. Why are you bothering her? She has done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you always have with you. And you can help them anytime you want, but you will not always have me. She did what she could. She poured perfume on my body beforehand to prepare for my burial. I tell you the truth, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, and what she has done will be told in memory of her. Love for God is not controlled by economics. Here she took this very expensive perfume in order to give, to pour it out on Jesus. You know, men do not just pick up a pebble off the street and seat it into a ring to give to someone to say, will you marry me? They get a diamond. They get something expensive. How much more is Christ worth? Love for the Lord is not controlled by economics, and it's not something that should be concealed. But it is something that is done lavishly. And so we are to show our love for the Lord lavishly and to express it daily by our obedience to Him. As Jesus says in John 14, verse 15, if you love me, you keep my commandments. That's just one of the ways that we love Him. We keep His commandments. And among those commandments, of course, would be the command to come together for the weekly convocation, to worship Him, to magnify His name. And so we express our love for Him lavishly, but also in our obedience to Him. Well, true greatness is found in loving the Lord. At least as a Christian, that's where true greatness is found. Not in all the letters that you might have after your name. Not in the accomplishments that you have listed in your curriculum vitae. But rather, do you love Him? And when Jesus returned to Peter after his ascension, after his resurrection, before his ascension, that was the one question he asked him. Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? Corresponding to three times where Peter had said, I don't know the man. I don't know him. I don't know what you're talking about. And Jesus gave him the opportunity to reverse that. And Peter answered, you know, Lord, I love you. And Jesus commissioned him. True greatness then is found in loving the Lord in a multitude of ways. And as you love Him, as your love for Him permeates your life, you will have what is good. You will enjoy Him. And so let your love for God be poured out because of what He has done for you.